"Good to give you back to us, sir," one said as he held the door. "The guards had no part in it. Catelyn Stark gave me back. Her and the Lord of the Dreadfort." He climbed the stairs and pushed into the solar unannounced, to find his father sitting by the fire. Lord Tywin was alone, for which Jaime was thankful. He had no desire to flaunt his maimed hand for Mace Tyrell or the Red Viper just now, much less the two of them together.
"Jaime,"
Lord Tywin said, as if they had last seen each other at breakfast, "Lord Bolton led me to expect you earlier. I had hoped you'd be here for the wedding." "I was delayed." Jaime closed the door softly. "My sister outdid herself, I'm told. 77 courses and a regicide. Never a wedding like it. How long have you known I was free?"
"The eunuch told me a few days after your escape. I sent the men into the Riverlands to look for you. Gregor Clegane, Samuel Spicer, the brothers Plum. Varys put out the word as well, but quietly. We agreed that the fewer people who knew you were free, the fewer would be hunting you."
"Did Varys mention this?" He moved closer to the fire to let his father see. Lord Tywin pushed himself out of his chair, breath hissing between his teeth.
"Who did this? If Lady Catelyn thinks—"
"Lady Catelyn held a sword to my throat and made me swear to return her daughters. This was your goat's work, Vargo Hoat, the Lord of Harrenhal." Lord Tywin looked away, disgusted.
"No longer. Sir Gregor's taken the castle. The sellsword deserted their erstwhile captain, almost to a man, and some of Lady Wenzel people opened the postern gate. Clegane found Hoat, sitting alone in the Hall of 100 Hearths, half mad with pain and fever, from a wound that festered. He is here, I'm told."
Jaime had to laugh. Too sweet. His ear. He could scarcely wait to tell Brian, though the wench wouldn't find it half so funny as he did. "Is he dead yet?"
"Soon. They have taken off his hands and feet. But Clegane seems amused by the way the Cahoric slumbers."
Jaime smiled curdled. "What about his brave companions?"
"The few who stayed at Harrenhal are dead. The others scattered. They'll make for ports, I'll warrant, or try and lose themselves in the woods."
His eyes went back to Jaime's stump, and his mouth grew taut with fury.
"We'll have their heads, everyone. Can you use a sword with your left hand?"
"I can hardly dress myself in the morning." Jaime held up the hand in question for his father's inspection. "Four fingers, a thumb, much like the other. Why shouldn't it work as well?"
"Good," his father said. "That is good. I have a gift for you, for your return. After Varys told me."
"Unless it's a new hand, let it wait." Jaime took the chair across from him. "How did Joffrey die?"
"Poison. It was meant to appear as though he choked on a morsel of food, but I had his throat slit open, and the maesters could find no obstruction."
"Cersei claims that Tyrion did it."
"Your brother served the king the poison wine, with 1,000 people looking on."
"That was rather foolish of him."
"I've taken Tyrion's squire into custody. His wife's maids as well. We shall see if they have anything to tell us. Sir Adam's gold cloaks are searching for this Stark girl, and Varys has offered a reward. The king's justice will be done."
"The king's justice? You would execute your own son?"
"He stands accused of regicide and kinslaying. If he is innocent, he has nothing to fear. First we must needs consider the evidence for and against him."
Evidence? In this city of liars, Jaime knew what sort of evidence would be found. Renly died strangely as well, when Stannis needed him to.
Lord Rinley was murdered by one of his own guards, some woman from Tarth.
That woman from Tarth is the reason I'm here. I tossed her into a cell to appease Sir Loras, but I'll believe in Renly's ghost before I believe she did him any harm. But Stannis?
It was poison that killed Joffrey, not sorcery.
Lord Tywin glanced at Jaime's stump again.
You cannot serve in the King's Guard without a sword end.
I can, he interrupted, and I will. There's precedent. I'll look in the White Book and find it if you like. Crippled or whole, a knight of the King's Guard serves for life.
Cersei ended that when she replaced Sir Barristan on grounds of age. A suitable gift to the faith will persuade the High Septon to release you from your vows. Your sister was foolish to dismiss Selmy, admittedly, but now that she has opened the gates,
someone needs to close them again. Jaime stood. I am tired of having high-born women kicking pails of shit at me, father. No one ever asked me if I wanted to be Lord Commander of the King's Guard, but it seems I am. I have a duty.
You do? Lord Tywin rose as well. A duty to House Lannister. You are the heir to Casterly Rock. That is where you should be. Tommen should accompany you as your ward and squire. The Rock is where he'll learn to be a Lannister, and I want him away from his mother. I mean to find a new husband for Cersei. Oberyn Martell, perhaps, once I convince Lord Tyrell that the match does not threaten Highgarden. And it is past time you were wed. The Tyrells are now insisting that Margaery be wed to Tommen. But if I were to offer you instead...
No! Jaime had heard all he could stand, no, more than he could stand. He was sick of it, sick of lords and lies, sick of his father, his sister, sick of the whole bloody business. No, 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 no! How many times must I say no before you hear me? Oberyn Martell? The man's infamous. And not for just poisoning his sword. He has more bastards than Robert, and beds with boys as well. And if you think for one misbegotten moment that I would wed Joffrey's widow...
Lord Tyrell swears the girl's still maiden.
She can die a maiden as far as I'm concerned.
I don't want her, and I don't want your rock. You are my son.
I am a knight of the King's Guard, the Lord Commander of the King's Guard, and that's all I mean to be. Firelight gleamed golden in the stiff whiskers that framed Lord Tywin's face. A vein pulsed in his neck, but he did not speak, and did not speak. And did not speak. The strained silence went on until it was more than Jaime could endure. Father, he began.
You are not my son.
Lord Tywin turned his face away.
You say you are the Lord Commander of the King's Guard, and only that. Very well, sir. Go, do your duty.
Davos. Their voices rose like cinders, swirling up into purple evening sky. Lead us from the darkness, O my Lord. Fill our hearts with fire, so we may walk your shining path. The night fire burned against the gathering dark, a great bright beast whose shifting orange light threw shadows 20 feet tall across the yard. All along the walls of Dragonstone, the army of gargoyles and grotesques seemed to stir and shift. Davos looked down from an arched window in the gallery above. He watched Melisande lift her arms as if to embrace the shivering flames.
"Relor," she sang in a voice loud and clear, "you are the light in our eyes, the fire in our hearts, the heat in our loins. Yours is the sun that warms our days, yours the stars that guard us in the dark of night."
"Lord of light, defend us. The night is dark and full of terrors."
Queen Selyse led the responses, her pinched face full of fervour. King Stannis stood beside her, jaw clenched hard, the points of his red-gold crown shimmering whenever he moved his head.
"He is with them, but not of them," Davos thought.
Princess Shireen was between them, the mottled grey patches on her face and neck almost black in the firelight.
"Lord of Light, protect us," the queen sang.
The king did not respond with the others. He was staring into the flames. Davos wondered what he saw there.
Another vision of the war to come? Or something closer to home?
"Relor, who gave us breath, we thank you," sang Melisande. "Relor, who gave us day, we thank you."
"We thank you for the sun that warms us," Queen Selyse and the other worshippers replied.
"We thank you for the stars that watch us. We thank you for our hearths and for our torches that keep the savage dark at bay."
There were fewer voices saying the responses than there had been the night before, it seemed to Davos. Fewer faces flushed with orange light about the fire. But would there be fewer still on the morrow? Or more? The voice of Sir Axel Florent rang loud as a trumpet. He stood barrel-chested and bandy-legged, the firelight washing his face like a monstrous orange tongue. Davos wondered if Sir Axel would thank him after. The work they did tonight might well make him the king's hand, as he dreamed.
Melisande cried, "We thank you, Faustinus. By your grace, our king, we thank you for the pure white fire of his goodness, for the red sword of justice in his hand, for the love he bears his leal people. Guide him and defend him, Relor, and grant him strength to smite his foes."
"Grant him strength," answered Queen Selyse, Sir Axel, Devon, and the rest. "Grant him courage, grant him wisdom." When he was a boy, the Septons had taught Davos to pray to the crone for wisdom, to the warrior for courage, to the smith for strength. But it was the mother he prayed to now, to keep his sweet son Devon safe from the Red Woman's demon god.
"Lord Davos, we'd best be about it."
Sir Andrew touched his elbow gently.
"My lord?"
The title still rang queer in his ears, yet Davos turned away from the window.
"Oi, it's time."
Stannis, Melisande, and the Queen's men would be at their prayers an hour or more. The Red Priest lit their fires every day at sunset to thank Relor for the day just ending, and beg him to send his son back on the morrow to banish the gathering darkness.
"A smuggler must know the tides and when to seize them."
That was all he was at the end of the day. Davos, the smuggler. His maimed hand rose to his throat for his luck, and found nothing. He snatched it down, and walked a bit more quickly. His companions kept pace, matching their strides to his own. The bastard of Nightsong had a pox-ravaged face and an air of tattered chivalry. Sir Gerald Gower was broad, bluff, and blonde. Sir Andrew Estamont stood a head taller, with a spade-shaped beard and shaggy brown eyebrows. They were all good men in their own ways, Davos thought.
"And they will all be dead men soon, if this night's work goes badly."
"Fire is a living thing,"
the Red Woman told him when he asked her to teach him how to see the future in the flames.
"It is always moving, always changing, like a book whose letters dance and shift even as you try to read them. It takes years of training to see the shapes beyond the flames, and more years still to learn to tell the shapes of what will be from what may be or what was. Even then it comes hard, hard. You do not understand that, you men of the Sunset Lands."
Davos asked her then how it was that Sir Axel had learned the trick of it so quickly. But to that she only smiled enigmatically and said,
"Any cat
may stare into a fire and see red mice at play.
He had not lied to his king's men about that or any of it.
The red woman may see what we intend, he warned them.
We should start by killing her, then, urged Lewis, the fishwife. I know a place where we could waylay her, four of us, with sharp swords.
You doom us all, said Davis. Maester Cressin tried to kill her, and she knew at once. From her flames, I guess. It seems to me that she is very quick to sense any threat to her own person, but surely she cannot see everything. If we ignore her, perhaps we might escape her notice.
There is no honour in hiding and sneaking, objected Sir Tristan of Tally Hill, who had been a sunglass man, before Lord Gunther went to Melisande's fires.
Is it so honourable to burn? Davis asked him. You saw Lord Sunglass die. Is that what you want? I don't need men of honour now. I need smugglers. Are you with me or no?
They were. Gods be good, they were. Maester Pylos was leading Edric Storm through his sons when Davis pushed open the door. Sir Andrew was close behind him. The others had been left to guard the steps and cellar door. The maester broke off.
That will be enough for now, Edric.
The boy was puzzled by the intrusion.
Lord Davis, Sir Andrew, we were doing sums.
Sir Andrew smiled. I hated sums when I was your age, cos.
I don't mind them so much. I like history best, though. It's full of tales.
Edric, said Maester Pylos, run and get your cloak now. You're to go with Lord Davis.
I am. Edric got to his feet. Where are we going? His mouth set stubbornly. I won't go to pray to the Lord of Light. I'm a warrior's man, like my father.
We know, Davis said. Come, lad, we must not dawdle.
Edric donned a thick hooded cloak of undyed wool. Maester Pylos helped him fasten it and pull the hood up to shadow his face.
Are you coming with us, Maester?
The boy asked.
No. Pylos touched the chain of many metals he wore about his neck. My place is here on Dragonstone.
Go with Lord Davis now, and do as he says. He is the king's hand, remember? What did I tell you about the king's hand? The hand speaks with the king's voice.
The young maester smiled. That's so. Go now. Davis had been uncertain of Pylos. Perhaps he resented him for taking old Crescent's place. But now he could only admire the man's courage.
This could mean his life as well.
Outside the maester's chambers, Sir Gerald Gower waited by the steps. Edric Storm looked at him curiously. As they made their descent, he asked,
Where are we going, Lord Davis?
To the water. A ship awaits you.
The boy stopped suddenly.
A ship?
One of Salador Sarn's. Sala is a good friend of mine.
I shall go with you, cousin, Sir Andrew assured him. There's nothing to be frightened of. I am not frightened, Edric said indignantly. Only, is Shireen coming too?
No, said Davis. The princess must remain here with her father and mother.
I have to see her then, Edric explained, to say my farewells, otherwise she'll be sad.
Not so sad as if she sees you burn. There is no time, Davis said. I will tell the princess that you were thinking of her, and you can write her when you get to where you're going.
The boy frowned.
Are you sure I must go? Why would my uncle send me from Dragonstone? Did I displease him? I never meant to.
He got that stubborn look again.
I want to see my uncle. I want to see King Stannis.
Sir Andrew and Sir Gerald exchanged a look.
There's no time for that, cousin, Sir Andrew said.
I want to see him, Edric insisted louder.
He does not want to see you.
Davis had to say something to get the boy moving.
I am his hand. I speak with his voice. Must I go to the king and tell him that you would not do as you were told? Do you know how angry that will make him?
Have you ever seen your uncle angry?
He pulled off his glove and showed the boy the four fingers that Stannis had shortened.
I have.
It was all lies. There had been no anger in Stannis Baratheon when he cut the ends off his Onion Knight's fingers, only an iron sense of justice. But Edric Storm had not been born then, and could not know that, and the threat had the desired effect.
He should not have done that, the boy said, but he let Davos take him by the hand and draw him down the steps.
The Bastard of Nightsong joined them at the cellar door. They walked quickly across a shadowed yard and down some steps under the stone tail of a frozen dragon. Lewis the Fishwife and Omer Blackberry waited at the postern gate, two guards bound and trussed at their feet.
The boat, Davos asked them.
It's there, Lewis said. Four oarsmen. The galley is anchored just past the point. Mad Prendis.
Davos chuckled.
A ship named after a madman. Yes, that's fitting.
Cella had a streak of the pirate's black humour. He went to one knee before Edric Storm.
I must leave you now, he said. There's a boat waiting to row you out to a galley. Then it's off across the sea. You are Robert's son, so I know you will be brave, no matter what happens.
I will, only...
The boy hesitated.
Think of this as an adventure, my lord.
Davos tried to sound hale and cheerful.
It's a start of your life's great adventure. May the warrior defend you.
And may the father judge you justly, Lord Davos.
The boy went with his cousin, Sir Andrew, out the postern gate. The others followed, all but the Bastard of Nightsong.
May the father judge me justly, Davos thought ruefully.
But it was the king's judgment that concerned him now.
These two?
Asked Sir Roland of the guards, when he had closed and barred the gate.
Drag them into a cellar, said Davos. You can cut them free when Edric's safely underway.
The Bastard gave a curt nod. There were no more words to say. The easy part was done. Davos pulled his glove on, wishing he had not lost his luck. He had been a better man, and a braver one, with that bag of bones around his neck. He ran his shortened fingers through thinning brown hair, and wondered if it needed to be cut. He must look presentable when he stood before the king. Dragonstone had never seemed so dark and fearsome. He walked slowly, his footsteps echoing off black walls and dragons.
Stone dragons, who will never wake, I pray.
The stone drum loomed huge ahead of him. The guards at the door uncrossed their spears as he approached.
Not for the Onion Knight, but for the king's hand.
Davos was the hand going in, at least. He wondered what he would be coming out.
If I ever do.
The steps seemed longer and steeper than before, or perhaps it was just that he was tired.
The mother never made me for tasks like this.
He had risen too high and too fast, and up here on the mountain the air was too thin for him to breathe. As a boy he had dreamed of riches, but that was long ago. Later, grown, all he had wanted was a few acres of good land, a hall to grow old in, a better life for his sons. The blind bastard used to tell him that a clever smuggler did not overreach, nor draw too much attention to himself.
A few acres, a timbered roof, a sir before my name. I should have been content.
If he survived this night, he would take Devon and sail home to Cape Wrath and his gentle Maria.
We will grieve together for our dead sons, raise the living ones to be good men, and speak no more of kings.
The chamber of the painted table was dark and empty when Davos entered. The king would still be at the night fire with Melisandre and the queen's men. He knelt and made a fire in the hearth to drive the chill from the round chamber and chase the shadows back into their corners. Then he went around the room to each window in turn, opening the heavy velvet curtains and unlatching the wooden shutters. The wind came in, strong with the smell of salt and sea, and pulled at his plain brown cloak. At the north window, he leaned against the sill for a breath of the cold night air, hoping to catch a glimpse of Mad Prendus, raising sail. But the sea seemed black and empty as far as the eye could see.
"Is she gone already?"
He could only pray that she was, and the boy with her. A half-moon was sliding in and out amongst high, thin clouds, and Davis could see familiar stars. There was the galley, sailing west. There the crone's lantern, four bright stars that enclosed a golden haze. The clouds hid most of the ice dragon, all but the bright blue eye that marked due north.
"The sky is full of smugglers' stars."
They were old friends, those stars. Davis hoped that meant good luck. But when he lowered his gaze from the sky to the castle ramparts, he was not so certain. The wings of the stone dragons cast great black shadows in the light from the night fire. He tried to tell himself that they were no more than carvings, cold and lifeless.
"This was their place once, a place of dragons and dragon lords, the seat of House Tregarion."
The Tregarions were the blood of old Valyria. The wind sighed through the chamber, and in the hearth the flames gusted and swirled. He listened to the logs crackle and spit. When Davis left the window, his shadow went before him, tall and thin, and fell across the painted table like a sword. And there he stood for a long time, waiting. He heard their boots on the stone steps as they ascended. The king's voice went before him.
"It's not three," he was saying.
"Three is three," came Melisande's answer. "I swear to you, Your Grace, I saw him die and heard his mother's wail."
"In the night fire?" Stannis and Melisande came through the door together. "The flames are full of tricks. What is, what will be, what may be. You cannot tell me for a certainty."
"Your Grace," Davos stepped forward, "Lady Melisande saw it true. Your nephew, Joffrey, is dead."
If the king was surprised to find him at the painted table, he gave no sign. "Lord Davos," he said, "he was not my nephew, though for years I believed he was."
"He choked on a morsel of food at his wedding feast," Davos said. "It may be that he was poisoned."
"He is the third," said Melisande.
"I can count, woman." Stannis walked along the table, past Old Town and the Arbor, up toward the Shield Islands and the mouth of the Mander. "Weddings have become more perilous than battles, it would seem. Who was the poisoner? Is it known?"
"His uncle, it said, the imp."
Stannis ground his teeth. "A dangerous man. I learned that on the Blackwater. How'd you come by this report?"
"The Iseni still trade at King's Landing. Salador San has no reason to lie to me."
"I suppose not." The king ran his fingers across the table.
"Joffrey. I remember once. This kitchen cat. The cooks were wont to feed her scraps and fish heads. One told the boy that she had kittens in her belly, thinking he might want one. Joffrey opened up the poor thing with a dagger to see if it were true. When he found the kittens, he brought them to show to his father. Robert hit the boy so hard, I thought he'd killed him."
The king took off his crown and placed it on the table. "Dwarf or leech, this killer served the kingdom well. They must send for me now."
"They will not," said Melisande. "Joffrey has a brother."
"Tommen," the king said the name grudgingly.
"They will crown Tommen and rule in his name."
Stannis made a fist. "Tommen is gentler than Joffrey, but born of the same incest. Another monster in the making. Another leech upon the land. Westeros needs a man's hand, not a child's." Melisande moved closer.
Save them, sire. Let me wake the stone dragons. Three is three. Give me the boy.
Adric's Torm, Davos said. Stannis rounded on him in cold fury. I know his name. Spare me your reproaches.
I like this no more than you do, but my duty is to the realm.
My duty.
He turned back to Melisandre.
You swear there is no other way?
Swear it on your life, for I promise you shall die by inches if you lie.
You are he who must stand against the other, the one whose coming was prophesied 5,000 years ago. The red comet was your herald. You are the prince that was promised, and if you fail, the world fails with you.
Melisandre went to him, her red lips parted, her ruby throbbing.
Give me this boy, she whispered, and I will give you your kingdom.
He can't, said Davos. Edric's Torm is gone.
Gone? Stannis turned. What do you mean, gone?
He is aboard the Lyseni galley, safely out to sea.
Davos watched Melisandre's pale, heart-shaped face. He saw the flicker of dismay there, the sudden uncertainty.
She did not see it.
The king's eyes were dark blue bruises in the hollows of his face.
The bastard was taken from Dragonstone without my leave. A galley, you say? If that Lyseni pirate thinks to use the boy to squeeze gold from me...
This is your hand's work, sire.
Melisandre gave Davos a knowing look.
You will bring him back, my lord. You will.
The boy is out of my reach, said Davos. And out of your reach as well, my lady.
Her red eyes made him squirm.
I should have left you to the dark, sir. Do you know what you have done?
My duty.
Some might call it treason. Stannis went to the window to stare out into the night.
Is he looking for the ship?
I raised you up from dirt, Davos. He sounded more tired than angry. Was loyalty too much to hope for?
Four of my sons died for you on the Blackwater. I might have died myself. You have my loyalty, always.
Davos Seaworth had thought long and hard about the words he said next. He knew his life depended on them.
Your Grace, you made me swear to give you honest counsel and swift obedience, to defend your realm against your foes, to protect your people. Is not Edric's Torm one of your people? One of those I swore to protect? I kept my oath. How could that be treason?
Stannis ground his teeth again. I never asked for this crown. Gold is cold and heavy on the head, but so long as I am the king, I have a duty. If I must sacrifice one child to the flames, to save a million from the dark...
Sacrifice is never easy, Davos. Or it is no true sacrifice. Tell him, my lady.
Melisandre said, Azor Ahai, tempered lightbringer, with the heart's blood of his own beloved wife. If a man with 1,000 cows gives one to God, that is nothing. But a man who offers the only cow he owns...
She talks of cows, Davos told the king. I am speaking of a boy, your daughter's friend, your brother's son.
A king's son, with the power of king's blood in his veins.
Melisandre's ruby glowed like a red star at her throat.
Do you think you have saved this boy, Onion Knight? When the long night falls, Edric Storm shall die with the rest, wherever he is hidden. Your own sons as well. Darkness and cold will cover the earth. You meddle in matters you do not understand.
There's much I don't understand, Davos admitted. I have never pretended elsewise. I know the seas and rivers, the shapes of the coasts, where the rocks and shoals lie. I know hidden coves where a boat can land unseen, and I know that a king protects his people
or he is no king at all."
Stannis' face darkened.
"You mock me to my face. Must I learn a king's duty from an onion smuggler?"
Davos knelt.
"If I have offended, take my head. I'll die as I lived. Your loyal man. But hear me first. Hear me for the sake of the onions I brought you and the fingers you took."
Stannis slid Lightbringer from its scabbard. Its glow filled the chamber.
"Say what you will, but say it quickly."
The muscles in the king's neck stood out like cords. Davos fumbled inside his cloak and drew out the crinkled sheet of parchment. It seemed a thin and flimsy thing, yet it was all the shield he had.
"A king's hand should be able to read and write. Maester Pylos has been teaching me."
He smoothed the letter flat upon his knee, and began to read by the light of the magic sword. John. He dreamt he was back in Winterfell, limping past the stone kings on their thrones, their grey granite eyes turned to follow him as he passed, and their grey granite fingers tightened on the hilts of the rusted swords upon their laps. "You are no Stark," he could hear them mutter, in heavy granite voices. "There is no place for you here. Go away." He walked deeper into the darkness.
"Father," he called. "Bran, Rickon."
No one answered. A chill wind was blowing on his neck.
"Uncle," he called. "Uncle Benjen. Father. Please, father, help me."
Up above he heard drums. "They are feasting in the great hall, but I am not welcome there. I am no Stark, and this is not my place." His crutch slipped, and he fell to his knees. The crypts were growing darker. "A light has gone out somewhere."
"Ygritte," he whispered. "Forgive me, please."
But it was only a direwolf, grey and ghastly, spotted with blood, his golden eyes shining sadly through the dark. The cell was dark, the bed hard beneath him. His own bed, he remembered, his own bed in his steward cell beneath the old bear's chambers. By rights it should have brought him sweeter dreams. Even beneath the furs he was cold. Ghost had shared his cell before the ranging, warming it against the chill of night, and in the wild Ygritte had slept beside him. Both gone now. He had burned Ygritte himself, as he knew she would have wanted. And Ghost? Where are you? Was he dead as well? Was that what his dream had meant? The bloody wolf in the crypts? But the wolf in the dream had been grey, not white. Grey, like Bran's wolf. Had the Thens hunted him down and killed him after Queen's Crown? If so, Bran was lost to him for good and all. John was trying to make sense of that when the horn blew. The horn of winter, he thought, still confused from sleep. But Mance never found Joramund's horn, so that couldn't be. A second blast followed, as long and deep as the first. John had to get up and go to the wall, he knew, but it was so hard. He shoved aside his furs and sat. The pain in his leg seemed duller, nothing he could not stand. He had slept in his breeches and tunic and small clothes for the added warmth, so he had only to pull on his boots and don leather and mail and cloak. The horn blew again, two long blasts, so he slung Longclaw over one shoulder, found his crutch, and hobbled down the stairs. It was the black of night outside, bitter cold and overcast. His brothers were spilling out of towers and keeps, buckling their sword belts and walking toward the wall. John looked for Pip and Gren, but could not find them.
Perhaps one of them was the sentry blowing the horn.
"It is Mance," he thought. "He has come at last."
That was good.
"We will fight a battle, and then we'll rest. Alive or dead, we'll rest."
Where the stair had been, only an immense tangle of charred wood and broken ice remained below the wall. The winch raised them up now, but the cage was only big enough for 10 men at a time, and it was already on its way up by the time John arrived. He would need to wait for its return. Others waited with him. Satin, Mully, Spareboot, Keggs, Big Blonde Harith with his buck teeth. Everyone called him Horse. He had been a stable hand in Molestown, one of the few moles who'd stayed at Castle Black. The rest had run back to their fields and hovels, or their beds in the underground brothel. Horse wanted to take the Black, though, the great buck-tooth fool. Zay remained as well, the whore who proved so handy with a crossbow. And Noy had kept 3 orphan boys whose father had died on the steps. They were young, 9 and 8 and 5, but no one else seemed to want them. As they waited for the cage to come back, Clydes brought them cups of hot mulled wine, while 3-Finger Hub passed out chunks of black bread. John took a heel from him and gnawed on it.
"Is it Mance Raider?"
Satin asked anxiously. "We can hope so." There were worse things than wildlings in the dark. John remembered the words the wildling king had spoken on the fist of the first men as they stood amidst that pink snow. When the dead walk, walls and stakes and swords mean nothing. You cannot fight the dead, Jon Snow. No man knows that half so well as me. Just thinking of it made the wind seem a little colder. Finally the cage came clanking back down, swaying at the end of the long chain, and they crowded in silently and shut the door. Mully yanked the bell rope 3 times. A moment later they began to rise, by fits and starts at first, then more smoothly. No one spoke. At the top the cage swung sideways, and they clambered out 1 by 1. Horse gave John a hand down onto the ice. The cold hit him in the teeth like a fist. A line of fires burned along the top of the wall, contained in iron baskets on poles taller than a man. The cold knife of the wind stirred and swirled the flames, so the lurid orange light was always shifting. Bundles of quarrels, arrows, spears, and scorpion bolts stood ready on every hand. Rocks were piled 10 feet high. Big wooden barrels of pitch and lamp oil lined up beside them. Bowen Marsh had left Castle Black well supplied in everything save men. The wind was whipping at the black cloaks of the scarecrow sentinels who stood along the ramparts, spears in hand. "I hope it wasn't one of them who blew the horn," John said to Donald Noy, when he limped up beside him.
"Did you hear that?"
Noy asked. There was the wind, and horses, and something else.
"A mammoth," John said. "That was a mammoth."
The armourer's breath was frosting as it blew from his broad, flat nose. North of the wall was a sea of darkness that seemed to stretch forever. John could make out the faint red glimmer of distant fires moving through the wood. It was Mance, certain as sunrise. The others did not light torches.
"How do we fight them if we can't see them?" Horse asked.
Donald Noy turned toward the 2 great trebuchets that Bowen Marsh had restored to working order.
"Give me light,"
he roared. Barrels of pitch were loaded hastily into the slings and set afire with a torch. The wind fanned the flames to a brisk red fury.
"Now!"
Noy bellowed. The counterweights plunged downward, the throwing arms rose to thud against the padded crossbars. The burning pitch went tumbling through the darkness, casting an eerie flickering light upon the ground below. John caught a glimpse of mammoths moving ponderously through the half-light, and just as quickly lost them again.
12, maybe more.
The barrel struck the earth and burst.
They heard a deep bass trumpeting, and a giant roared something in the old tongue, his voice an ancient thunder that sent shivers up John's spine.
"Again!"
Noy shouted, and the trebuchets were loaded once more. Two more barrels of burning pitch went crackling through the gloom to come crashing down amongst the foe. This time one of them struck a dead tree, enveloping it in flame.
"Not a dozen mammoths," John saw. 100.
He stepped to the edge of the precipice.
"Careful,"
he reminded himself. "It's a long way down." Red Allen sounded his sentry horn once more. "Ahoo! Ahoo!" Another wildlings answered, not with one horn, but with a dozen, and with drums and pipes as well.
"We are come," they seemed to say. "We are come to break your war, to take your lands and steal your daughters."
The wind howled, the trebuchets creaked and thumped, the barrels flew. Behind the giants and the mammoths, John saw men advancing on the wall with bows and axes. Were there 20 or 20,000? In the dark, there was no way to tell. "This is a battle of blind men, but Mance has a few thousand more of them than we do."
"The gate!" Pip cried out. "They're at the gate!"
The wall was too big to be stormed by any conventional means, too high for ladders or siege towers, too thick for battering rams. No catapult could throw a stone large enough to breach it. And if you tried to set it on fire, the ice melt would quench the flames. You could climb over, as the raiders did near Greyguard, but only if you were strong and fit and sure-handed. And even then, you might end up like Jarl, impaled on a tree.
"They must take the gate, or they cannot pass."
But the gate was a crooked tunnel through the ice, smaller than any castle gate in the Seven Kingdoms, so narrow that rangers must lead their garrons through single file. Three iron gates closed the inner passage, each locked and chained and protected by a murder hole. The outer door was old oak, 9 inches thick and studded with iron, not easy to break through.
"But Mance has mammoths," he reminded himself, "and giants as well."
"Must be cold down there," said Noy. "What say we warm them up, lads?"
A dozen jars of lamp oil had been lined up on the precipice. Pip ran down the line with a torch, setting them alight. Owen the Oaf followed, shoving them over the edge one by one. Tongues of pale yellow fire swirled around the jars as they plunged downward. When the last was gone, Gren kicked loose the chucks on a barrel of pitch and sent it rumbling and rolling over the edge as well. The sounds below changed to shouts and screams, sweet music to their ears. Yet still the drums beat on. The trebuchets shuddered and thumped, and the sound of skin pipes came wafting through the night like the songs of strange, fierce birds. Septon Celador began to sing as well, his voice tremulous and thick with wine.
"Gentle Mother, Fount of Mercy, save our sons from war, we pray. Stay the swords and stay the arrows, let them know."
Donal Noy rounded on him.
"Any man who stays his sword, I'll chuck his pocket ass right off this wall. Starting with you, Septon. Archers? Do we have any bloody archers?"
"Here," said Settin.
"And here," said Molly. "But how can I find a target as black as the inside of a pig's belly? Where are they?"
Noy pointed north.
"Loose enough arrows. Might be you'll find a few. At least you'll make them fretful."
He looked around the ring of firelit faces.
"I need 2 bows and 2 spears to help me hold the tunnel if they break the gate."
More than 10 stepped forward, and the smith picked his 4.
"John, you have the wall till I return."
For a moment John thought he'd misheard. It had sounded as if Noy were leaving him in command. "My lord?"
"Lord?" I'm a blacksmith. I said, the wall is yours.
There are older men, John wanted to say, better men. I'm still as green as summer grass. I'm wounded, and I stand accused of desertion. His mouth had gone bone dry.
I,
he managed. Afterward, it would seem to Jon Snow as if he'd dreamt that night. Side by side with straw soldiers, with longbows or crossbows clutched in half-frozen hands, his archers launched 100 flights of arrows against men they never saw. From time to time, a wilding arrow came flying back in answer. He sent men to the smaller catapults and filled the air with jagged rocks the size of a giant's fist, but the darkness swallowed them as a man might swallow a handful of nuts. Mammoths trumpeted in the gloom. Strange voices called out in stranger tongues, and Septon Celador prayed so loudly and drunkenly for the dawn to come that John was tempted to chuck him over the edge himself. They heard a mammoth dying at their feet and saw another lurch burning through the woods, trampling down men and trees alike. The wind blew cold and colder. Hub rode up the chain with cups of onion broth, and Owen and Clydus served them to the archers where they stood so they could gulp them down between arrows. Zaye took a place among them with her crossbow. Hours of repeated jars and shocks knocked something loose on the right-hand trebuchet, and its counterweight came crashing free, suddenly and catastrophically, wrenching the throwing arm sideways with a splintering crash. The left-hand trebuchet kept throwing, but the wildlings had quickly learned to shun the place where its loads were landing. "We should have 20 trebuchets, not 2, and they should be mounted on sledges and turntables so we could move them." It was a futile thought. He might as well wish for another 1,000 men, and maybe a dragon or 3. Donal Noy did not return, nor any of them who'd gone down with him to hold that black coal tunnel. "The wall is mine," John reminded himself whenever he felt his strength flagging. He'd taken up a longbow himself, and his fingers felt crabbed and stiff, half-frozen. His fever was back as well, and his leg would tremble uncontrollably, sending a white-hot knife of pain right through him. "One more arrow, and I'll rest," he told himself, 50 times. "Just one more." Whenever his quiver was empty, one of the orphan moles would bring him another. "One more quiver, and I'm done." It couldn't be long until the dawn. When morning came, none of them quite realized it at first. The world was still dark, but the black had turned to grey, and shapes were beginning to emerge, half-seen from the gloom. John lowered his bow to stare at the mass of heavy clouds that covered the eastern sky. He could see a glow behind them, but perhaps he was only dreaming. He notched another arrow. Then the rising sun broke through to send pale lances of light across the battleground. John found himself holding his breath as he looked out over the half-mile swathe of cleared land that lay between the wall and the edge of the forest. In half a night, they had turned it into a wasteland of blackened grass, bubbling pitch, shattered stone, and corpses. The carcass of the burned mammoth was already drawing crows. There were giants dead on the ground as well. But behind them, someone moaned to his left, and he heard Septon Celador say, "Mother, have mercy, oh, 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 mother, have mercy." Beneath the trees were all the wildlings in the world, raiders and giants, wargs and skin changers, mountain men, salt sea sailors, ice river cannibals, cave dwellers with dyed faces, dog chariots from the frozen shore, hornfoot men with their souls like boiled leather, all the queer wild folk Mance had gathered to break the wall. "This is not your land," John wanted to shout at them. "There is no place for you here. Go away." He could hear Tormund Giantsbane laughing at that. "You know nothing, Jon Snow," Ygritte would have said. He flexed his sword hand, opening and closing the fingers, though he knew full well that swords would not come into it up here. He was chilled and feverish, and suddenly the weight of the longbow was too much. The battle with the Magnar had been nothing, he realized, and the night fires less than nothing, only a probe, a dagger in the dark to try and catch them unprepared. The real battle was only now beginning.
"I never knew there'd be so many," Satin said.
John had. He'd seen them before, but not like this, not drawn up in battle array. On the march, the wilding column had sprawled over long leagues like some enormous worm, but you never saw all of it at once. But now... "Here they come," said someone in a hoarse voice. Mammoth centered the wildling line, he saw, 100 or more, with giants on their backs, clutching mauls and huge stone axes. More giants loped beside them, pushing along a tree trunk on great wooden wheels, its ends sharpened to a point. A ram, he thought bleakly. If the gate still stood below, a few kisses from that thing would soon turn it into splinters. On either side of the giants came a wave of horsemen in boiled leather harness with fire-hardened lances, a mass of running archers, hundreds of foot, with spears, slings, clubs, and leathern shields. The bone chariots from the frozen shore clattered forward on the flanks, bouncing over rocks and roots behind teams of huge white dogs. The fury of the wild, John thought, as he listened to the skirl of skins, to the dogs barking and baying, the mammoths trumpeting, the free folk whistling and screaming, the giants roaring in the old tongue. Their drums echoed off the ice like rolling thunder. He could feel the despair all around him.
"There must be 100,000, Saturn wailed. "How can we stop so many?"
"The wall will stop them," John heard himself say. He turned and said it again louder. "The wall will stop them. The wall defends itself." Hollow words, but he needed to say them, almost as much as his brothers needed to hear them. "Mance wants to unman us with his numbers. Does he think we're stupid?" He was shouting now, his leg forgotten, and every man was listening. "The chariots, the horsemen, all those fools on foot, what are they going to do to us up here? Any of you ever seen a mammoth climb a wall?" He laughed, and Pip and Owen and half a dozen more laughed with him. "They're nothing. They're less use than our straw brothers here. They can't reach us, they can't hurt us, and they don't frighten us, do they?" "No!" Gren shouted. "They're down there, and we're up here," John said, "and so long as we hold the gate, they cannot pass. They cannot pass!" They were all shouting then, roaring his own words back at him, waving swords and longbows in the air as their cheeks flushed red. John saw Keggs standing there, with a war horn slung beneath his arm. "Brother," he told him, "sound for battle." Grinning, Keggs lifted the horn to his lips and blew the two long blasts that meant wildlings. Other horns took up the call until the wall itself seemed to shudder, and the echo of those great, deep-throated moans drowned all other sound. "Archers," John said, when the horns had died away, "you aim for the giants with that ram, every bloody one of you, loose at my command, not before. The giants and the ram. I want arrows raining on them with every step, but we'll wait till they're in range. Any man who wastes an arrow will need to climb down and fetch it back. Do you hear me?"
"I do," shouted Owen the Oaf. "I hear you, Lord Snow."
John laughed like a drunk or a madman, and his men laughed with him. The chariots and the racing horsemen on the flanks were well ahead of the center now, he saw. The wildlings had not crossed a third of the half-mile, yet their battle line was dissolving. "Load the trebuchet with caltrops," John said. "Owen, Keggs, angle the catapults toward the center. Scorpions,
load with fire spears and loose at my command. He pointed at the Molestown boys. You